today on Against the Grain, Eco-Modernism and Degrowth. These are two currents within eco-socialism. What does each tendency stand for and advocate? I'm CS. We present for the first time my full-length interview with David Ravensbergen, writer, activist, and PhD student in social and political thought, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Some socialists call themselves eco-socialists, but even that category has subcategories, that is, positions or tendencies within eco-socialism that differ in important ways. Two prominent tendencies within eco-socialism are degrowth and eco-modernism. Last month, we presented a two-segment program featuring a pair of contributors to a volume called Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination. Today, we present for the first time my full-length interview with one of those scholars, David Ravensbergen. In his essay in that volume, David, a doctoral candidate in social and political thought at York University in Toronto, lays out both the eco-modernist vision and the degrowth position, and considers which might be more suitable and effective for a left ecological politics. Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left is edited by Robert Latham, A.T. Kingsmith, Julian von Bargen, and Nico Bloch. David Ravensbergen has published work on Marxism, climate change, and the political economy of the environment. When David joined me recently, I asked him about the importance of mending sectarian divisions on the left and of coming up with a political project that people can unite around.
Well, C.S., I think that my approach to the question of overcoming sectarianism, augmenting the left in the terms of the book, is really informed by the urgency of climate change and the ecological crisis. I don't want to obscure the fact that there are meaningful differences, differences that have persisted in some cases for hundreds of years between different groups on the left, different tendencies. At the same time, I think that there's sufficiently common ground for an augmentation, again, in the terms of the book, around the life or death project of building an ecological politics capable of mitigating the worst of the climate crisis and the ecological crisis more generally.
Could the left come up with a political program suitable for our times without understanding and taking into account the scale and the severity of the ecological crisis?
I think that this is a question that haunts contemporary left politics. I think that there remains, although there is widespread recognition of the severity of the climate and ecological crisis, there remains a kind of silo effect where climate or the environment remain, they're considered as kind of distinct issues, as niche issues to be considered alongside a whole host of other traditional left concerns. And I think that that's a major mistake because many of the assumptions, the priorities, the traditions of the left that have animated this tradition for the last 150, 200 years, they really require some fundamental re-examination in a context in which, we're facing a potentially rapid and radical transformation in the ecosystems that have given rise to complex human civilization as we know it over the course of the last 10,000 years, over the Holocene period of relatively stable environmental conditions. So I think that to overlook the enormous role that ecological transformation will play in determining what is possible in the century ahead is a grave mistake for the left.
What about anti-capitalist critiques that focus on inequality and not climate change, you know, critiques that focus on the importance of redistributing wealth. Do you see those kinds of critiques as promoting visions of the future that are sustainable from an ecological standpoint?
I think that we need to be clear about redistributive politics and what they are aiming at and how they are framed. I think that, you know, one of the fundamental problems of the kind of inheritance of the left that we have today is that, you know, for much of the last century, left politics, whether, you know, predominantly social democratic but also more radical, has often been focused on winning material gains for working people. And that is really the way that it should be. You know, capitalism is a system that is plagued by obscene levels of inequality, by oppression, by exploitation, and a redistributive politics is an essential component of the left. But as we, you know, from the perspective of the contemporary ecological crisis, look at the prospects for a redistributive politics going forward, you know, we have to really call into question the basis of redistribution, the ecological basis of redistribution. And one of the messages of the ecological crisis is that it's insufficient for our political horizon to be defined only in terms of redistribution when the sustainability of the larger system, of the larger political economy in which that redistribution is taking place, is radically called into question.
Yeah, and as you write in your essay, generalizing the high rates of resource and energy use in rich countries is an ecological impossibility. What have you observed in the case of some left-leaning governments in South America in terms of socialist projects that didn't take environmental concerns seriously enough?
Well, I want to start off by making a key distinction here, which is between eco-socialist politics in the global south and the global north. The historical legacies of uneven development in the capitalist world system mean that the challenges, the conjuncture, the situation faced by socialist politics in these two parts of the world are quite different. That being said, I think there are, you know, there's real lessons that can be drawn across the divide. So in the case of Latin America, particularly during the pink tide period from the late 90s through the 2000s, there was, you know, we saw this major upsurge of left struggle, success of left electoral politics coupled with the power of an insurgent left social movement base. And once in power, you know, we saw pink tide governments making huge strides in redistributing wealth in countries that had historically been outrageously unequal. And there were real material gains made there in places like Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia. We saw major improvements in the standard of living, improvements in literacy, improvements in health outcomes for the very poorest. And those kinds of outcomes are to be celebrated. Nevertheless, the ability of those pink tide governments to pursue redistributive politics was in large part enabled by the commodity supercycle, by the long boom in commodity prices that provided major state revenues to these governments on the basis of expanded extraction, mining, oil and gas development, etc. This isn't a critique that I level as a kind of outside observer from the North, but this is rather a critique that was central, or a tension that was central to the dynamic of the pink tide itself, wherein pink tide governments were pursuing these redistributive politics on the basis of extractive revenues, but began to face, especially in countries like Ecuador, major resistance from those who bore the brunt of the extraction that was generating the revenue. And I'm thinking particularly of indigenous movements and of smallholder farmers. So there's a real question here when we're thinking of redistribution, you know, who benefits and who bears the cost? And that's really central to the eco-socialist problematic.
I want to ask you to define and describe eco-socialism in a moment. But first, I want you to talk about kind of the contrasting vision of what a left climate strategy should entail that you identify in this essay that you wrote for the book Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left. And that is eco-modernism. What is eco-modernism?
So when speaking about eco-modernism, it's important to make a distinction between what I would think of as high eco-modernism, mainstream eco-modernism, represented by groups like the Breakthrough Institute, and socialist eco-modernism, eco-socialist eco-modernism. There's significant overlap between the two, but they are somewhat distinct. Eco-modernism, as promoted by the Breakthrough Institute, is what is described by many of its proponents as a variant of post-environmentalist thought. So it's kind of rooted in this recognition that environmentalism as a social movement, as an attempt to limit the destruction of nature, was a failed strategy, and that instead of what eco-modernists would say was, you know, a kind of romantic movement of kind of back to the land or, you know, valuing nature for its own sake, eco-modernism proposes to really take the management of nature into human hands. And in doing so, they advocate a vision of high technology development. They advocate intensive urbanization. They advocate nuclear power and a kind of concentration of human activity in smaller and smaller areas, leading to the possibility of rewilding greater parts of the earth and allowing species that are currently under pressure from sprawling development a chance to regain a foothold. Now, the left variant of eco-modernism it's rooted in Marxism. It's rooted in a kind of Promethean current that we find throughout the history of Marxism, a kind of emphasis placed on the scientific mastery of nature, on the importance of technological and industrial development as expressions of human ingenuity. It has a strong anthropocentric focus, so really, really thinking about the world through the lens of what is important for human purposes.
Tell me a little bit more about technology and the promise that it holds out for eco-modernists, I think of either stripe, of both stripes, although maybe the emphasis is different, as you were saying. What kinds of technologies do eco-modernists appeal to? Do they say will help us get out of or address the ecological crisis?
Well, the key thing to highlight for an eco-modernist perspective is that the most realistic, the most achievable, the most promising avenue for social transformation, for resolving the ecological crisis, is through technological development. So they would say, you know, we're not going to pursue a strategy of changing social relations or, you know, the structure of the economy, but rather we want to unleash the potential of science and technological progress to provide solutions to the challenges that we face. So, you know, there's not complete consensus on which technologies are put forward as possible solutions, but they range from nuclear power to what we're seeing increasingly emphasized now in the climate debate geoengineering technologies, carbon capture and storage, and other kind of large-scale direct interventions into the natural world to dramatically bring down carbon emissions to limit the scale of ecological disaster.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. David Ravensbergen joins me. He is a PhD student in social and political thought at York University in Toronto, and he contributed an essay entitled The Anthropocene and Us, Grounds for an Augmented Left, with a question mark, to the volume Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination. Some eco-modernists, they also advocate a kind of automation of production. Could you talk about that and also what that means for some of these thinkers and writers and activists in terms of the future of work and labor?
I think the question of automation is a theme that has deep roots in the Marxist tradition. There's a variant of Marxism that has often been called forces of production determinism. And it's this kind of idea which is drawn from primarily from some remarks that Marx makes in the 1859 preface to a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy. This idea that, you know, contrary to what Marx generally argues, which is that class struggle, movements of people engage in struggle is really what drives history. This variant would say that, you know, it's really technological development that is the kind of engine of historical development. And so we see that in some contemporary thinkers on the eco-modernist side, I think most clearly represented by Aaron Bastani's paradigm of fully automated luxury communism. This idea that technology has reached a point where human labor is becoming increasingly redundant in the production process. And really the only thing that is holding us back from realizing an emancipatory future is the fetters that are placed on technology by these kind of obsolete relations of production. So because there's, you know, a class of wealthy capitalists or rentiers that own technology, and they're not allowing us to realize the full potential of that technology, we're stuck working long hours. We're stuck with the benefits of, you know, new information technologies, of AI, and so on, accruing to a small group of owners rather than liberating the majority from the necessity of work.
I see. So this will benefit workers and free up time for them. What does Aaron Bastani say about how and whether reductions in energy use are required? And I'm also wondering what he wrote about asteroid mining.
Bastani's position, and you know, it's an evolving one, so I'm referring back to something that he wrote a couple of years ago. It may have changed, but he argues essentially that the idea that responding to the climate crisis would require reductions in energy use doesn't feel right to him. As a real proponent of technological development as an engine of social change, he sees, you know, the falling cost of solar energy, of wind energy. He sees this as evidence that we're on a kind of trajectory that's going to allow us to continue to develop in the way that we have. It's going to continue to allow rising energy consumption, material consumption around the world, because we are getting more adept. We're becoming more adept at harnessing what he thinks of as the limitless power energy of the sun. And this kind of is, you know, this is the transition to the asteroid question. Bastani is a big fan of some companies that seem fairly speculative today, although there is increasing interest from, you know, billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos in the question of space exploration and space extraction. Bastani is interested in companies like Planetary Resources, who claim that there are, within our solar system, reachable from Earth, near-Earth asteroids that contain trillions of dollars in valuable metals and minerals. And their proposition is that if we are able to go to space and extract those metals and minerals, that we will essentially solve the problem of scarcity once and for all and lay the groundwork for a kind of intergalactic civilizational expansion. And so Bastani, you know, puts a left gloss on this and says, if we are to overcome scarcity as these companies claim, well, we might as well then implement communism.
And I want to get your kind of evaluation of eco-modernism as we discuss, as I have you discuss, the debates between eco-modernists and other left tendencies. And let's talk about kind of the left tendency that you put in opposition to, that you claim justifiably kind of contrasts with an eco-modernist vision, and that is degrowth. What are the basic features of the degrowth outlook?
So there's a number of different ways to define and to approach degrowth. I think the way that I'm going to take is to locate it also within the Marxist tradition. And that's not something that is shared by all advocates of degrowth. But nonetheless, I think it's a useful illustration. So as I was saying about eco-modernism drawing on this kind of forces of production determinism within Marxism that sees technology as the driving force of progress of history, there's a kind of a countercurrent that I would say is in some ways nicely illustrated by a figure like Walter Benjamin. For Walter Benjamin, we don't think of history as being this unfolding of technological progress and, you know, increasing perfection that will eventually create the conditions for a socialist society. But in the Theses on the Philosophy of History, Benjamin has this evocative image of the angel of progress being borne forward into the future on the storm of progress, looking back at the accumulation of disaster behind. And so for Benjamin, the idea of a revolutionary socialist politics is to find a way to pull the emergency brake on this kind of out of control developmental train. Thinking about the problem as it appeared in his lifetime in the first half of the 20th century, Benjamin said that the German labor movement's greatest downfall was that it believed it was swimming with the current of technological development. And so that's a way of thinking about degrowth is, you know, it is a movement against the grain, if you will, to say that the development of capitalist modernity and industrial progress, while it certainly contains beneficial elements, is to be resisted and contains within it a kind of logic of endless expansion, endless growth, and also endless degradation and destruction of nature that needs to be fundamentally stopped and overturned.
Yeah, and here I think you're referring to the D in degrowth, right? That there is so often a focus on economic growth and economic progress, human progress. The degrowth folks are pushing back against that. And what specifically, and maybe it's hard to generalize, but what specifically do they call for?
So, I mean, I think a degrowth politics really rests fundamentally on this recognition that ceaseless growth is one of the kind of primary organizing principles of all societies, essentially, within contemporary global capitalism. And to organize your society any society around endless expansion is to invite a whole host of problems. So we see the kind of demand for endless consumption of energy in the form of fossil fuels is driving the climate crisis. Endless demand for metals, materials is driving rampant extractivism and the social dislocation that results. We see the promotion of a kind of restless consumerism, endless desire for more is the driving force behind the exploitation of labor in around the world, but increasingly, in poor countries in the global south. It's driving the accumulation of waste and garbage that is disrupting ecosystems. So degrowth really points to the fact that we have a politics that uses this quite innocent language of, GDP growth and expansion and so on, and claims that this is a kind of uncontested social good for everyone, because the more growth we have, the more there is for everyone. Degrowth says, this is a fundamentally irrational and destructive organizing principle, and we need to consider other ways of organizing society, and not just consider. It's an urgent imperative in light of the rapidly vanishing window of time to act to limit carbon emissions and to slow and mitigate many of the other facets of the ecological crisis, including the unfolding sixth mass extinction.
My guest is David Ravensbergen. He is a union activist. He's a PhD student at York University in Toronto. He's published work on Marxism, climate change, and the political economy of the environment. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I think when many people, maybe the people who consider degrowth politics, many of them might discern a tenor of scarcity, of deprivation, of going without, doing without, right? Degrowth has this image of no longer moving forward and no longer expecting the kinds of consumption patterns and other ways of living that we have become accustomed to. How do you respond to that? I mean, what should we say about whether degrowth promises scarcity, in contrast, by the way, to the kind of vision of abundance that many eco-modernists forward, such as, Aaron Bastani, who, as you said, did not believe that we needed to reduce energy use because, after all, there are clean energy sources in abundance.
Yeah, I think this is really one of the most common points of contention in the debate between a degrowth and an eco-modernist position. I think the first thing that I would say is that although degrowth is often accused of advocating a politics of scarcity, it is in fact the reigning neoliberal consensus, rooted as it is in neoclassical economics, which is actually grounded fundamentally in scarcity. The idea of growth, which can be traced back, actually has been traced back usefully by degrowth scholar Yorgos Kallas to Malthus, is that we exist under conditions of fundamental scarcity. There's not enough to go around, and the only reasonable way of responding to that is to pursue a politics, a political economy of endless growth, of endlessly getting more. But I think that it's clear, whether degrowth or socialist or social democratic, any kind of critical perspective on contemporary capitalism would look and see that growth has not delivered the goods. It has delivered an enormous share of wealth to a extraordinarily small percentage of the population, and it is generating increasing instability and precarity and ecological degradation for the majority. So I contest the idea that degrowth is a politics in scarcity. I would say that it's the dominant paradigm of neoliberalism that is rooted in scarcity, and that the eco-modernist position actually shares much more in common with that neoliberal paradigm in accepting this need for constant growth. I would say that, you know, degrowth scholars have been quite clear that degrowth should not be seen as synonymous with austerity politics or with some kind of enforced poverty. You know, again, if we look at the austerity politics that have characterized the neoliberal era, the kind of cuts that have been made to social spending, the sacrifices in quality of life that people have been asked to make, those have all been made for the sake of growth. You know, we've all been told we need to make these sacrifices, we need to suffer cuts to education funding, we need to suffer cuts to healthcare funding, to pensions, all in order for the economy to grow. I think, in contrast, degrowth envisions a world where scarcity is it's not a kind of timeless law, it's not a fundamental principle of the planet, it's rather something that is socially constructed. And it's socially constructed by the system of capitalism. Whereas, you know, degrowth says perhaps it is not scarcity, but rather abundance that characterizes this planet that we live on together. And the question is not, you know, should we do with less or should we do with more, but it's rather a qualitative question. You know, degrowth is really a kind of a project of democratically, of collectively asking, how do we want to meet our needs? How do we want to satisfy our desires? Is it only through this kind of singular metric of growth and endless expansion that we can do that? Or are there other ways that would be less destructive, less oppressive to people, less exploitative, and perhaps most fundamentally of all, would be less apocalyptic for the ecosystems that we depend upon?
So we've been talking about two currents of eco-socialism, degrowth and eco-modernism. How do those two currents differ on the question of a political strategy and on the question of which groups in society ought to take the lead in moving the eco-socialist agenda forward?
Well, I think that, you know, if we think about degrowth and eco-modernism as kind of two currents of thought that are visible within the broader paradigm of eco-socialism, we have to think that, you know, eco-socialism is subject to all of the same strategic questions and constraints that, you know, non-eco-socialism and all other left emancipatory movements are subject to. So, you know, we all face these questions of, can electoral politics transform the state and put it to work for non-capitalist ends? Is there no escaping the necessity for revolution? I think, you know, someone like the late Eric Olin Wright lays out all of the different historical forms that this debate has taken in works like his book, How to Be an Anti-Capitalist in the 21st Century. And I think for me, you know, the takeaway from reading a kind of overview like that of all of the different forms that left strategy has taken historically is that there really is no widespread agreement on the way forward today. That said, I think that the two tendencies within eco-socialism, they do have some shared recognition on the need for something like industrial policy. I think when we face up to the magnitude of the ecological crisis that we're facing today, it's clear that decarbonization on the scale and the speed that is required isn't going to happen without some kind of planned transformation of economic life. And that's something that is presumably going to have to happen at the level of the state. I think, interestingly also, you know, the question of strategy doesn't map so neatly onto the divide between degrowth and eco-modernism. So there's people within the degrowth camp who see the political task as being, you know, simply convincing policymakers using rational arguments that infinite growth is
untenable on a finite planet, and we simply need to shift away from GDP and growth and so on. And then there are many others within the degrowth camp who are diehard social movement activists who want to build, you know, low energy, carbon free communes based around agroecology and so on. At the same time, eco-modernists, I think they really vary between, you know, on the one hand, just sort of hyping up the alleged emancipatory benefits of, you know, AI or asteroid mining or whatever kind of new technology is on offer, and believing that that is sort of going to do the work of political transformation. And then, you know, we also see many people who have a kind of eco-modernist bent taking a more kind of traditionally Marxist line, that political transformation happens through workers' movements and mass strikes as the kind of primary vehicle of change. In terms of the imagined coalition or the proposed coalition for either a degrowth or eco-modernist politics, I'd say that a key difference is really that degrowth is seeking to include political actors and agents who have sometimes been absent from a kind of more traditional Marxist conception of historical change. That includes looking towards the global south, that includes smallholder farmers or indigenous peoples in the global north. You know, that expands to, you know, thinking about the actions that we saw from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe or the Wet'suwet'en solidarity blockades around Canada last year. You know, to things like the rent strikes that are currently unfolding in cities across the U.S., I think there's a more big tent conception of the actors involved in political transformation within the degrowth conception.
His name is David Ravensbergen. He is a PhD student in social and political thought at York University. He's written widely on climate change, on radical politics, on the political economy of the environment. And among other things, he's contributed an essay about eco-socialism and its various strands and the importance of the left uniting around the urgency of the climate change and environmental crisis to the new volume. It's called Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about kind of how to address the environmental and ecological crisis. You mentioned jobs creation. The Green New Deal obviously has a high degree of visibility these days. It's become a rallying cry for climate activists. What do you think of the sort of policy package that is the Green New Deal?
There are some potential problems with the Green New Deal. One problem that we could think of is, you know, the analogy, the clear connection that's being made here to the original New Deal points to the problem that, you know, is really highlighted by the degrowth perspective. If we think of the original New Deal policy as, in some senses, designed to really salvage an ailing capitalist system in the United States and shore up domestic capital accumulation, I think that there's a lot of that original goal from the New Deal is present in the Green New Deal. And this is a major problem in a situation in which we can really identify ceaseless economic growth as one of the primary drivers of the climate and ecological crisis. Another issue that comes up is that the Green New Deal is kind of obscuring some other frameworks, some other political frameworks for thinking about the climate crisis that have been fought for by activists, by movements, by countries in the global south for years. And one of those in particular is the climate justice perspective. And the key thing to take away from the climate justice perspective is this emphasis on unequal responsibility for the climate crisis. You know, the overwhelming majority of emissions have come from the countries of the capitalist core, the United States, Western Europe, Japan. But it's also the unequal vulnerability to the effects of the climate crisis. So it's primarily, you know, those who have contributed the least in the global south who are most vulnerable to the most severe effects of you know, extreme weather, flooding, famine, and so on. And so with the Green New Deal framing, there's a tendency to think about the problem of climate change and climate policy really as a domestic problem. You know, it's how do we create jobs in the United States for American workers? How do we fix American cities and so on? And the thing is, you know, if we're really talking seriously about, you know, massive electrification of transportation, a massive shift to renewable energy and so on, that's a project that is going to depend on raw materials, minerals, supply chains that stretch into the global south, into the countries that have historically, you know, again, borne the brunt of extraction, of economic dependence within the capitalist global economy. So I think it's important to recognize that there are these kind of tendencies within the Green New Deal discourse, a tendency to think of it in terms of, you know, domestic economies, or to think of it in terms of a means of jump-starting growth that we need to be aware of. But nonetheless, it is it's a promising opening in the sense that there's a real opportunity to influence the shape of discussions around what the political response to this unprecedented ecological crisis will be.
What about the phenomenon of the so-called doomer or catastrophist politics or vision? David Wallace Wells came out with a book with the eye-catching, if intensely sobering, title The Uninhabitable Earth. And Jem Bendel has forwarded the concept of deep adaptation. What stance does eco-socialism, or the strands that you stand behind, take toward the claim that it's, you know, it's too late to avert ecological catastrophe?
Well, eco-socialism is fundamentally a political project for transformation. So, you know, it's really not a recipe for political quietism. And it's certainly not a kind of millenarian cult that's you know, bringing people together to wait for the end of the world. So in that sense, you know, a kind of doomer or catastrophist outlook really has not much of a role in an eco-socialist politics. That being said, I do think that some of the work of people like Wallace Wells and Bendel or Roy Scranton and others, I think some of it has been a bit unfairly maligned as advocating, you know, giving up or saying that it's too late to do anything. I think there is some value in engaging with what they're saying. And I think, you know, for me, primarily what that value is to engage with their insistence that what we think of as normal today can't be preserved. Essentially, what we think of as normal is this very historically contingent form of life that was made possible by a massive boom in fossil fuels, that was made possible by the unequal structure of the capitalist world system that has delivered abundance to the few in the capitalist core, and you know, real deprivation to the rest of the world. And I think, you know, when we consider just the enormity of the changes that are coming, that we know from climate science, from ecologists more generally, the changes that are coming in the century ahead, I think it's clear that this form of life, this, you know, this blip on the timeline of human history, to say like the last few decades, this normal, it doesn't have a future. And I think that's what the doomer or catastrophist thinkers are really asking us to come to terms with. You know, it's really to extend our political horizon beyond, you know, this world around us that now seems like it's the way that things have always been and how they always will be, and to say, you know, the meaning of climate change, the meaning of the ecological crisis is that these things will change. And the question then, you know, for the left is, you know, what are we going to do as this new terrain emerges? Are we going to be able to bring about, to contribute to the development of a more egalitarian, a more ecologically sane society? Or are we going to be kind of mired in a defense of this form of life that we have now, which is at a deep level truly unsustainable? So I think, you know, it depends on the way that you read the doomers or the catastrophists, but I think that there are some questions there that are worth engaging with.
All right, so we've been talking about eco-socialist strands, tendencies, currents. The eco-modernist position is certainly one. The degrowth movement is another. Are you arguing that the left needs to sort of unite around one or another of these strands, that this debate between how to proceed toward eco-socialist goals needs to be resolved in some way in order that the left can present an adequately united front to achieve the goals, you know, the overall goals of preventing planetary destruction?
Well, I think that in a sense, yes, in a sense, no. I think that in the kind of immediate future, the task of restraining ecocidal capitalist development is sufficiently clear to virtually all segments of the left. I think, you know, we all or most of us recognize that, you know, in order to reduce carbon emissions with the speed and at the scale necessary identified by climate scientists, we need to stop fossil fuel development. We need to put a moratorium on new fossil fuel extraction. We need to stop building pipelines. We need to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. We need to stop building fossil intensive infrastructure. These are the kinds of things that I think we can really unite around without having to engage with the more utopian, in a sense, questions of what kind of a society we're really struggling to build and work towards. But I do think that, you know, as I mentioned, speaking about catastrophism and the doomer position, you know, the more that we gaze beyond the kind of immediate fights for decarbonization towards the middle term horizon of, you know, real deep social transformation, the more we come up against some of these debates where visions of the future, visions of, you know, a new kind of post-capitalist socio-ecological future, their incompatibility becomes clear. And I think that while it may not be essential right now for us to adjudicate between, you know, a degrowth or eco-modernist or other positions as we struggle to shut down pipelines, for example, or to pursue more equitable economic policies around things like, you know, ensuring that people are paid better or that work is more equitably distributed and so on. Once we start to think about, you know, what kind of a world are we trying to build? What kind of a world are we trying to preserve? We're really going to have to ask some long and hard questions about the extent to which we think technology is going to be something that we can rely on to resolve the crises that we face, or whether we need to really be building towards a kind of more fundamental transformation in the way that our societies are organized, moving away from, you know, an emphasis on private consumption, on capitalist notions of personal freedom, towards what Kristen Ross calls communal luxury, or Kate Soper talking about the kind of new hedonism, the pleasures of post-growth living, the idea that we could really advance an entirely different societal vision, not rooted in an extension of the current developmental technological paradigm, but rooted in, you know, different social values, values that celebrate community, that value care, that value cooperation, and that, you know, respect the larger earth community of plants and animals, the larger ecosystems that that make up this planet that we inhabit.
David Ravensbergen, PhD candidate in social and political thought at York University. He is also a writer, a union activist. He's written about political theory, about climate change. You can find an essay he wrote about the Anthropocene in Us, Grounds for an Augmented Left, with a question mark. That's the title of the article that he contributed to the volume, Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination. David, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you, CS. It's been a real pleasure to have the chance to talk to you today.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.